Hey everybody, Patrick Connor here, and welcome to the Knuckles and Gloves podcast. Man, we had a hell of a heavyweight title fight last night. We couldn't help but schedule a very quick recap, quick turnaround recap on Fury Wilder 3. So I'm here with my two good friends, Bryn Jonathan Butler, author, filmmaker, and my buddy Aris Pina, historian, CompuBox operator. Man, Bryn, what did you think about that? Did you get to go see it in the theater? How did everybody love it? What was it like?
It was just fucking incredible. I mean, I just loved it. I thought it was so exciting and dramatic and stressful. And I mean, to me, that's like the ultimate metric of a great fight is you had two colossal guys. I'm not even necessarily a huge fan of either of them. And it didn't make any difference because of the tension that was in the fight, the back and forth, the drama of Wilder just holding this fucking eraser at any moment, Fury not being in as good condition. So he was definitely concerned with his stamina. He'd usually have maybe two flurries around. And other than that, kind of taking his foot off the gas. But both of their determination, this incredible speed chess match between the two of them at times, and just feeling like their lives are on the line. But on a certain level, like it was kind of somehow became Foreman Lyle, right? Like I just thought it had everything in terms of the drama. I need some time away from it to think was it as good a fight as say Klitschko Joshua, but I think maybe it was better just because the way I was invested in it, and I was just sure that Wilder was just so unwilling to give up. And just uncorking those huge right hands again and again and again when you thought he had nothing left. And then Fury closing the show, even though it looked like, I mean, you guys tell me, but I thought at least six or seven times Fury put him out and then leaned on him and kept him up. And then Wilder would get gas again and come back with something. So I was so like angry that Fury wouldn't end the fight, because you saw like in the third round, which is what I predicted when he would win it, he almost put him away. The referee interrupts them for 9 seconds, which was pivotal for Fury to close out the show. And then I thought, oh, Wilder's going to take it when he dropped Fury with that huge punch. So I just loved it. I'm still kind of like, I didn't get home until 3 o'clock in the morning. I biked home from Brooklyn and, I was just amazed by it. Did you guys enjoy it as much as I did?
Aris, dude. Did you love that shit or what?
I lost my mind watching that fight. Are you kidding me? I was hoping to meet you guys in Brooklyn, actually, but I've been under the weather with a bad sinus infection, so that wasn't going to happen. But so I watched it from my apartment, and I mean, I probably scared the hell out of my neighbor because I, you know, like you said, it was just, you get so invested in a fight like that. There's really nothing like heavyweight boxing, man. Even when it's sloppy, whatever you want to do, there's just the dramatics, the one punch factor in it. Everything about it is just like, you know, it's wild. And a guy like Wilder, who even though he seems like he could be on the brink, he did change a little bit. He did, you know, make adjustments in the beginning, but he got rid of that game plan quickly. And the minute he got rid of that game plan quickly, he went right back to reverting to, you know, trying to be the bomber that he is and knocking the hell out of Fury. And he was almost able to do it. And, you know, I remember I was texting my boy at that time, and I was like, oh, Wilder looks finished. I was like, unless he lands a wild shot, this might be it. And all of a sudden, Fury walked into that right hand that would have knocked the shit out of any other heavyweight completely, who'd still be sleeping today. And I would, you know, that's when everything changed. I was like, oh my God. And from there, it just became, even though Fury was in control of the majority of those rounds, it still became one of those like, back and forth, who's finally going to drop Wilder? Even when he was hurt in the 10th round again, he got dropped. He came back and hurt Fury again at the end of the round. Like, you just never knew until it was definitively over. One of the best fights I've ever seen, one of the best heavyweight fights I've ever seen. And this trilogy now stands up, I would say, with the best of any of them.
Dude, anybody talking down about the fight, yeah, anybody saying anything about the fight at this point is just a fucking hater, dude. I mean, look, often when heavyweight boxing is at its greatest, it's sloppy, it's brutal, it's jarring. I mean, Dempsey Firpo, we're coming up on 100 years We're coming up on 100 years since Dempsey Firpo. It was in 1923. People are still fucking talking about that shit. That didn't even go two full rounds. Two rounds. People are still talking about Dempsey Firpo to the point where, like, when you bring up, like, all-time greatest heavyweight slugfest, like, just on reflex, people are like, Dempsey Firpo. Dempsey Firpo. You know what I mean? Like, that's, they might not ever even have seen it. But you got Lewis Klitschko. I mean, let's get the hyperbole out of the way. I might as well, right? Holmes Norton, Foreman Lyle, Ollie Frazier 3. I'm not saying that Fury Wilder 3 is the same as those fights or as good or in the same level or anything as, you know, much notoriety. I'm just saying that those are some of the greatest heavyweight fights that we can all think of and that we think of when we talk about the greatest fights. Because obviously there are great fights between some random ass middlemen here and there, but we're talking about the stakes. That's often what makes the fights great too. And the stakes were massively high last night. You know, the two men exhausted, pushing themselves beyond the limit, you know, beyond the limit of like what normal people know is possible. But, you know, ultimately that's what boxing is when it's at its greatest. And heavyweight, when heavyweights are doing it, it's like there's something a little different about it. So, I mean, I'm not saying that Fury Wilder 3 is the same as those other great fights, but you look at those other great fights and they had all of similar elements that Fury Wilder 3 had. And almost none of those fights were like, you know, fucking highbrow, high art, you know, sport type of shit. Like, they were brutal and fucking rough. So in any case, the brutality and the roughness isn't on its own what made them great. But man, what a fucking great fight last night, dude. You had the shifts of momentum, both guys down, both guys hurt. You know, there were moments too where I thought that they both showed skill. It wasn't all just sloppy. You know, Deontay Wilder came out with a new game plan. I don't want to lean too much on that because I think that sometimes too much can be made of that type of shit. But he very clearly opened up the fight doing something different. He wound up having to adjust. Tyson Fury adjusted to that, et cetera, et cetera. It had all of the elements of a classic.
And I think the other thing is just in the context of the trilogy is it's like every one of these fights, like it might be one of the most rewatchable trilogies ever. Because you think like even Gaddy and Mickey Ward, yeah, I mean, the first one is just unforgettable, but it just kind of went down. Now I'm saying it started off as the most epic kind of battle of the 20s.
Well, and the first, like, you know, I think it was like the first three or four rounds were kind of like, eh, and then Ward opens up in like the fifth, like in toward the end of the round, it's like, whoa, he's still alive. And then it was kind of like, all right, we're back to the blah, blah. And then like rounds 8 and 9 came, it was like, what the fuck? So there were a lot of moments of kind of like lulls, just like the second and third fight. So there wasn't as much sustained action as we wound up seeing.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think also like Ali Frazier, the second fight, I don't think a lot of people are, you know, desperately rewatching that fight, but all three of these fights have something totally different in them. And you're right. Like with this, Wilder came out in the first round, it was like, ooh, and Fury was very different. Fury did not have... He had the confidence, but he became a little bit more measured. And you thought, ooh, this could open up some possibilities for Wilder that are interesting. Ooh, it's going to be a lot more dangerous than we thought. And then he reverted basically the next round, Wilder, to what we'd seen before. He just wasn't able after one training camp to transform into this new fighter that some people seem to believe that he could. But he showed so much heart. Like, I mean... so much determination. As much as I can't stand his sort of version of showmanship leading into these fights, it makes me cheer against him. But the guy you saw, I mean, every time they flash to his wife in the audience, and it's like, she doesn't have to be upset. She can be proud of what he is. No, she can be upset too.
He's dying before our eyes. She could be upset.
Yeah, and you know... For somebody who was desperate to go out on his sword, that was a real point of honor for him. I wonder what it's going to be like now losing in one of the most iconic knockouts in heavyweight history. If there was HBO at the beginning and you get the great music coming on, this would be one of the silhouettes you'd see of Fury just turning that right hand over and leveling this guy. Who, by the way, if you watch the way Wilder fell, if his arm wasn't on the rope, he was about to topple down like that bare knuckle boxer who died. He was going to go head first into the apron. He got very lucky in terms of the way he collapsed. Like, I could have ended his career possibly. So I don't know. Like, I just wonder in terms of Wilder going back to look at this, like there's a lot brought up. I think Kellerman kept talking about ego maintenance with how all he had all these excuses for the second fight. What are the excuses for this fight? I don't know, but he was, the way he went out, I just wonder if he's going to sort of have to recontextualize his whole role in boxing, or maybe he wants to come back and fight Joshua or something like that. But he took one of the worst beatings I've seen in a long time. Like, it made the second fight, which was brutal, look like a walk in the park compared to the beating he took. Like, I tweeted right after it happened, this is a beating he's going to feel for the rest of his life, and it's only going to get worse. And Fury did what he said he was going to do in terms of administering that beating. But I also think if Fury had been in better condition, different fight, but this is the fight that we had, and you just have such an incredible, like a triptych of, you know, I feel like if you're waiting to become a grandfather to show your grandkid, you won't believe what happens in the first one. And then the second one, you won't believe how different it is and how exceptional this is. And then maybe the third is even better than the first two. I mean, how many of those do we have to talk about in any weight class?
Yeah, there aren't a whole lot of trilogies that kind of like crescendo with the third fight. Assuming this is the last fight between them, it probably should and will be.
Probably for heavyweights would be Bo Holyfield.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, look, all three fights were solid. The first one, I would say Fury Wilder might be the best. This fight might be the best heavyweight title fight since the first Bo Holyfield fight. Or close to it, you know, it was a couple of them discussion. And second fight, again, was very dramatic, not just for about Fan Man, because it was just really closely contested throughout the end until Holyfield finally, you know, was able to edge it out. And in the third fight, even though Holyfield was suffering from hepatitis, Bo wasn't at his absolute best either, and they were both a little bit past it, and they made for a memorable brawl that featured multiple knockdowns in itself, too. That looked like Holyfield was still about to take it over until he finally, you know, lost his energy again, and Bo was able to finish him. And that fight actually kind of reminds me of Fury Wilder. I think, though, Fury Wilder still edges it out in terms of longevity, all the other ebbs and flows of it, and how it ends. But I would give a good comparison to Bo Holyfield 3. Or even more, Burt Cooper, for that matter. Michael Moore, Burt Cooper.
No, that's a good one. I was thinking of that, too. Burt Cooper and Michael Moore is a great one. That's a great one. The back and forth, it's like one of the most rewatchable fights I return all the time. That's a great comparison. And I think it was up there, too. I mean, the great heavyweight fight you left out, Patrick, obviously, is Evander Holyfield and Bobby Chez. I mean, one of, you know, I wish Manscaped was there to promote that fight, because, you know, you need to get through that wilderness, get to the action.
Yeah, it was definitely a forest for the trees kind of fight. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
But
get that wood. Get that Chez wood.
You know, the choppy wood. Now, this third fight last night was almost like if you took the first two fights and put them together, because it had that element of the first fight where Deontay Wilder has a couple of very dramatic moments, actually. But then there's also the element of the second fight where Tyson Fury is just kind of beating him down, and Deontay Wilder's repeatedly getting hurt. And that's kind of like, I know that he did get what he wanted. He got what he wanted in the sense that he didn't want the fight to be stopped. He didn't want anybody to, he wanted to be able, I guess, to leave no stone unturned or something like that. So that he couldn't say that anybody stepped in for him, that he did it all himself and whatnot, or maybe that's not his reason. I don't know, but whatever the case, he didn't want anybody stopping it. And he wanted to be able to kind of go out, as it were. And he got that. I mean, he definitely got that, but I guess it's a fair question to ask whether or not the fight should have really been stopped before that, because the last few rounds were a beatdown. But I will say, not to ride the fence off of what I just fucking said, but man, the end of that round 10 was like, Tyson Fury starts putting it on Deontay Wilder in round 10, And he's looking like, oh shit, dude, he's done. He's going to get like hurt badly here. And then all of a sudden, right at the end of the round, it's like he has Tyson Fury rocking and rolling from like 10 shots. I was like, whoa, holy shit. But that was really about a last hurrah. And then after that, it looked like it could have just been stopped at pretty much any time, to the point where, you know, he got beaten down so much that last knockdown, not trying to go into like the anatomy and physiology of a fucking knockdown here, but he literally fell, and it was like he was obviously hurt, but he wasn't unconscious. It was like he just had nothing. He was just like, ugh, fuck, dude. You know, like it was like you could almost see it on his face. Like he was just like, I don't have it to get up, dude. I'm so done. And it was, and to me, that was kind of like the sign of like he got beaten down probably a little bit too long. And again, what he wanted, but could that have been stopped like in the middle of the 10th round or something, or the 11th round or something, just to save him a couple of, you know, a couple of years on his life?
But I think the referee was given by Wilder the benefit of the doubt of every round because of exactly what you mentioned in the last round, the 10th round. Wilder looked again out on his feet. He was about to be finished. And then Fury got caught with some more shit that Wilder can always do at the last second. And Fury wobbled a little bit. And I mean, it was sad to see Wilder go out the way he did, because he was obviously knocked the hell out. And just like, that's like a definitive finish right there. Like, you're just out. You know what I mean? No energies, no nothing. You just collapse. It's done. That's how he wanted to go out. I understand that. But as a person who's now taken back-to-back serious beatings, and he's, I think, what, 36 now or so? 35. As a heavyweight. 35, yeah. So it's like, I'm not sure how, you know, he can, how he's going to, I don't know how his career arc will be after this. I mean, obviously, he still has the factor of his right hand and his power, and I'm sure he can knock the hell out of most people in the division. I'm going to personally watch all of his fights. I think he's fantastic to watch, just for that matter. But it's going to be interesting to see how, you know, if anything's really taken away, if he's going to be completely different from this, because those were bad beatings.
I also wonder about his confidence. I mean, the way he came in there, he had this look of discouragement on his face. Like, I mean, he's trying to maintain this armor, this image. This previous fight, it was stolen from me. Mark Breland took it from me. But when you watch Fury, like, he's totally relaxed. He enjoys being there. And that's stressful to look at that across the ring. Wait a minute, I've got a 95% knockout percentage. You should be intimidated by me, and I can feed on you being intimidated. And Fury, there's no intimidation on his face. He enjoys it. He called him a bitch at the outset,
yep.
Like before the bell rang. He's having fun. And I think that's a really scary thing. It's an element that I haven't really seen it at this level of the sport, other than with Muhammad Ali. Tyson is tense before a fight. Tyson dreamt before every fight that he lost. Ali goes in there like, this is where I belong. I deserve center stage in the world. Mm-hmm. And this is exactly where I want to be. And Fury has that quality. And that alone, I think, saps 30% of his opponent's energy. And with Wilder too, who's, you know, trying to put the pieces back together from the second fight, he looked tired. Like, I don't know how much of it was his size being the biggest weight that he'd ever been. He looked in incredible condition. And I think his conditioning ultimately was the rejuvenating factor. Every time he would get kind of mildly concussed from a shot, you'd see his conditioning bring him back enough so that he could throw something back. So, I mean, these are all the elements that just made it so tense, because Fury just did not have the conditioning to be able to go in there and not worry about, ooh, if I throw three or four punches, could I punch myself out? Because it looked like he was very cognizant of punching himself out at any moment in that fight, and that Wilder would see it and then capitalize off of it, because their wills were so closely matched in the fight, which is, I think, was the fuel of it. And I think the other element, which is going to be really intriguing for Wilder going forward, is the sense of, if he was in there with anybody other than Tyson Fury, he probably could have beaten them. He probably could have done this to Joshua. He, like, done exactly what he wanted to do to Joshua. Probably could have done this to Usyk, but not Fury. And this is the third time where he's lost almost every round he's faced this guy, where he hasn't been able to put him on the canvas. And I just don't know how mentally, emotionally, he's going to be able to deal with that, where we haven't heard the excuses yet, but he didn't lose well in this fight either. Fury said in the post-fight press conference that he went over and said, well done. And Wilder said, I'm not going to offer you sportsmanship. And I think it's just because what he's being confronted with this loss is also the second fight's loss and probably the first fight's loss. And I think every time that replay comes up, and it's going to come up forever. Like, no matter how many victories this guy had, no matter how many times he did this to other people, the biggest memory of his career is going to be what Fury just did to him. And he's only discovering that fact now.
Well, and I think that if this were a handful of years ago, you could say, well, Deontay Wilder's young. He's got time to come back. And yep. I guess there is that element of 35 is not that old in today's heavyweights. You know, he could ostensibly have several years left in his career and have time left to reclaim some semblance of a signature win or something like that. But I think you bring up a pretty good point, dude. That was a very definitive win. It was a very definitive end to their series. And when you bring up his size and his bulk, yeah, I don't think that was really the correct way to go, or at least I think that he probably was putting on weight in the wrong places, because he was obviously much bigger in his upper body, had bigger shoulders, bigger pecs and stuff like that. And it looks great, but his legs are still pretty skinny. It didn't look like he did much work on his legs, or perhaps it's just really difficult for him to put muscle on his legs on. I don't know. I'm not a fucking fitness expert, obviously, but regardless, I think that was probably a mistake, putting on all of that kind of weight. And that it probably affected his delivery, because he's a free swinging puncher. He's not the kind of puncher that is very technically sound or textbook. He needs like distance. He needs range on his delivery. And I think that kind of muscle probably hindered that a little bit, but even so, he was able to land that shit. But then you bring up the excuses and stuff like that. And I guess if I had my only complaint, I guess, and it's not even so much a complaint, I guess it's more a concern as far as the discourse going forward. But the only thing about the fight was that Tyson Fury did just enough things in the fight that I could see Deontay Wilder or his fans complaining. Like, he was hitting him behind the head. Like, for instance, they were saying that in Deontay Wilder's corner to the referee in a few rounds. He's hitting behind the head. Realistically, in a number of those exchanges, they were both hitting behind the head. They were both pushing each other around. It was just that Tyson Fury's got him by like 40 pounds or something like that. So it's, when you're like 6 or 11 or whatever the fuck, and you're fucking, 280 pounds and pushing somebody around, he got 40 pounds on him. That's what it's going to look like. But kind of in that regard, I could see some complaints about, it was a dirty fight or it was a rough fight. But even so, Deontay Wilder said that going in, that he expected that he expected Tyson Fury to kind of lean on him, that's what he had done in the second fight, and that he had been really physical with him. So anyway, I think that's probably the only thing that I could even remotely see being complained about. Otherwise, I thought it was pretty clear and definitive.
I totally agree with you. I wanted to ask you, though, were you as sensitive to the way the referee was operating in that fight as I was? Because I noticed the beginning Russell of every Moore's round, awful. He's awful. In the beginning of every round, he would take up about 5 or 6 seconds, just bring them together. Whoa, wait. And I'm like, this is not your role to do this. You're not giving them any chance to have inside fighting at all. Like, it after the third round, the knockdown, there was so much preamble to letting them go back to fighting, where I'm kind of like, what are you doing here? Like this Fury has earned this opportunity to close out this round, and you are inserting yourself in a way that seems extraordinarily biased toward Wilder. I was getting really frustrated by it, also because Fury didn't have the stamina to really go in there and try to close the show. But the refereeing really pissed me off in that fight.
So a quick anecdote for anybody listening and unfamiliar, Russell Moura is the was the referee in Abner Mares versus Joseph Agbeko 1, that infamous fight where Abner Mares just like landed low blow after low blow after low blow, like several times. And then Joseph Agbeko winds up getting quote unquote knocked down, which was actually a really bad and low illegal blow. And then Russell Moore counts it as a knockdown, and that affects the outcome of the fight, and Abner Mares winds up winning. Actually, right after that fight, that was what, like 2011, I think, I sent Russell Moore an email, and he emailed me back like 20 minutes later, and he was basic, and because I was like, whoa, what the hell were you doing during that fight? Like, I wasn't even that nice about it. And he said something to the effect of, I'd have to go look, but he said something to the effect of, yeah, I messed up, I'm gonna have to talk to some people or something like that. And that was about it. It was short. And then sure enough, he winds up getting quote unquote re-educated, or having some sort of continuing education through none other than Jay Nady and Joe Cortez. And I'm sitting here thinking like, whoa, what? They're sending a bad referee to Jay Nady and Joe Cortez, who have like some of the most head scratching. And so then you can see that kind of like a really interjecty style from Russell Moore, that Jay Nady, has that same kind of style where he's constantly being vocal, like to the point where it's interrupting the fight. No, stop, you know, that type of shit. And it's like, bro, this is not about you. I know that you're refereeing to heavyweights, but you're like screaming your face off to the point where you're interrupting the fight. You're literally interrupting the flow of the fight. So yeah, I'm with you, dude. It was a poor refereeing job. And Russell Moore has a history of very poor refereeing jobs. And sorry to go on a tangent, but this is just one of those issues in boxing of officials that we keep seeing come back again and again and again, despite really shitty performances. And that we'll get back to the fight, but
it played a big role. Like, that's my only point, is it played a completely unnecessary large role.
Why was he chosen? Here's the thing. I can't remember the last time he was in a big fight, unless I'm missing something, because I don't keep track of reps like that. But that exactly the thing is, when the last time I really remember him was during the Agbeko Mares fight. So why was he chosen for this fight?
I don't know. There's the Nevada State Athletic Commission used to be considered the gold standard, and that along with New York, the Nevada State Athletic Commission used to be considered the standard, to the point where if they instituted some rule, or if they had some suspension or something like that, the other state commissions usually upheld them. But like now, just speaking frankly, dude, their officials suck. Their head of their commission is terrible and is constantly saying some laughable shit to the press. I can't speak much on New York's commission at this point, although I know they've been under fire ever since Magomed Abdusalamov's and that injury and the handling of that. So I know that there have been problems, but I can't speak to who's in charge right now. Point is, we keep seeing the same officials and stuff like that. It's like, who are these people? Why are they here? If I did a shitty job all of the time at my job, I wouldn't have that job. So why are these people allowed to keep their jobs when they keep doing shitty jobs?
Yeah. Well, what for you, did you, like, were you feeling like when the bell rang, were you changing your mind about, you know, who was going to win? Like, where did you guys go watching this thing in terms of, because I probably changed my mind about 10 times about who I thought was going to finally take it over, which is really rare. Like there's not usually that many kind of sea changes in a fight.
What do you think, Harris?
Even in the first round, I thought Fury, even though Wilder came out and was working the body and, you know, showing a little bit of different look, that Fury was still just taking his time getting adjusted and just figuring things out. But eventually by the end of the round, he was already kind of back in control. If you remember, like, he landed a couple of right hands and seemed like he was getting his range. So I figured at that point that it might take two or three rounds because he's been out of the ring for a minute, but he's just going to figure him out and just go from there. When Wilder dropped him, I figured at that point that, especially after the second knockdown, I mean, I've seen Fury drop before, we all have, but like the look in his face, you can tell that like he was really trying to like fight whatever was going on in his head, because he was obviously foggy and there was like a lot going on there. And I was just like, holy shit, this might be the time he might like be done. And if it wasn't for a lot of what a lot of people are calling a generous count by Mora, And, you know, it happening at the very end of the round, the second knockdown, that might have been the difference, because I'm not sure if Fury would have survived if those two knockdowns happened at the beginning of the round like that. You know what I mean? So, you know, it's interesting to look at that way. But then again, when Fury started getting back in control soon after that, and that's why I mentioned before, Fury has some of the best recuperative powers I've ever seen. Like, he's on Larry Holmes type level when it comes to that stuff. You know, any other guy would have been completely cooked from that, especially from that first knockdown. That was such a clean right hand. And you see Fury's like body just kind of shivered with it when he got hit. It was similar to the punch that knocked out Luis Ortiz in the rematch. Just one of those short, compact, right there, smash, you know, knocks you silly. And Fury was somehow able to get up from that. He was still completely out of it because he went down again, but I think he was benefited by the end of the round. He was able somehow to recover from that. And as he recovered, he slowly got back in control. And from there, I just figured, what? Even though, unless he was going to get hit with something wild, which he almost did a couple of times, I felt he was mostly in control and he was just grinding down Wilder. So,
did you guys, either of you guys check that? Because I haven't heard that there was some question about the count that Fury was.
I heard that on Twitter. Yeah, a few people have said that. And to be honest, I did not pay attention because I was so caught up in the moment of Fury actually being dropped that I wasn't even paying attention to the actual count like that. But a lot of people on Twitter did make a comment of it saying that more, that was a ridiculously long count. It was about 15 seconds or so.
Well, yes, I did see that. I saw the same thing. And looking back, it did seem like, I would say it was a generous count. However, here's the thing. When it comes to administering counts, when it comes to referees administering counts, almost nobody seems to give a shit to look at a fucking stopwatch like they're on like fucking Greenwich time or some shit, like on this goddamn knockdown. Like, you know, it's officially 11.9 seconds. Like, dude, come on. Almost never do these knockdowns, like they have somebody admit a timekeeper administering or helping with the account. That's what you hear ringside, and you probably heard them more prominently in decades past or in eras past, the timekeeper, you know, or see them ringside holding up fingers, 1, 2, stuff like that. And they still do it though, and the referee is supposed to look to the timekeeper ringside in order to pick up the count, and the timekeeper is supposed to be going by a stopwatch or clock so that each toll, 1, 2, 3, is a second, but it very rarely is. I'm not trying to be like ultimately philosophical or technical here, but I'm just like speaking honestly, nobody really seems to pay attention to this unless their favorite fighter just got knocked down and the fucking
Tyson Douglas.
Yeah.
What's that? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh, he's got a long knock. I mean, come on, dude.
1, 2, 20, 28, 56.
And meanwhile, when Tyson gets knocked down, he gets up and he can't even get his mouthpiece back in. He's so fucked up. So it's like, how do you parse this here? But yes, I did hear that. The first count, I will say, somewhat generous. What looked like happened on the second count was that Mora turned around and was having to direct Deontay Wilder to the neutral corner, which also is something that happens regularly. Fuck, I brought up Dempsey before and talking about Tunney Dempsey too and the long count. You know,
there's Joe Walcott with Ali and Liston in the second fight.
It happens. You know what I mean? So it's like what the referee is technically supposed to do is pick up the count where they left off. Like they're not supposed to, you know, have this imaginary clock in their head as they're directing fighters. Like that's too much to put on a referee, dude. So anyway, I think that that's probably inserting too many variables into this shit. And it's much easier to just focus on what happened with the punches. You know what I mean? Like it's much easier to just look at what was happening in the ring. And that was, like you said, Aris, and like you also said, Brent, it was just a slow beatdown, dude. Tyson Fury looked composed. And even in that first round, toward the end of that first round, like you said, Aris, he had started kind of figuring that rhythm and he looked comfortable. He looked less distressed when knocked down and hurt than Deontay Wilder did. Whereas Deontay Wilder, one thing he was doing, and I guess it just reminds me of this fight because it stands out so much in my head, but Jermaine Taylor versus Bernard Hopkins won. I remember toward the end of the fight when Bernard Hopkins starts coming on, Jermaine Taylor kept going to the ropes and turning his back, like turning around, like from the right hands and shit. And Deontay Wilder was doing the exact same thing, going to the ropes and then going, ooh, ooh, you know, from the right hand.
Because Taylor and Wilder both are very like kind of stiff and
kind of raw. Energy.
Yeah, very.
Yeah. And like just, and he was doing that same kind of thing over and over. And to me, it was just like, it made it look so much more dramatic. Every single time Fury would land something and he was like turning around, it was like, there's no hiding it, dude. There's no hiding that you just got hurt or that you're stunned or something. Whereas Fury was able to take like the mustard off of some of these shots a lot better. Or even if when they were landing good, it almost took them, you know, two or three more shots to go down from that first knockdown. I mean, that first right hand, they showed the ultra slow-mo replay and you see the fucking wave of fat go down from his head. Yeah,
and his body just jiggled from that, bro. I was thunderstruck.
It's like that Simpsons episode where he pokes him in the stomach and he's like, great, now we have to time it to see when the fat stops jiggling and it just goes. No, you know, it's he literally took another two or three more shots before going down. It was like he was still kind of composed in the process of going down. I think that you said that earlier, Bryn, that the composure, it made a big difference, that lack of stiffness and that kind of preparedness, it makes a big difference style wise and also in the ability to take punishment, to get up from shots. And an additional two times Tyson Fury getting up from knockdowns that were just brutal, dude. I mean, you have to give Tyson Fury some credit, but also Deontay Wilder some credit, because he was hurt multiple times during the fight and he kept going through and would have gotten up from that final knockdown possibly had it not been like, okay, holy shit, please somebody help this guy. You know, it was, you gotta give both
guy in that ring, literally he was ready to go. He didn't care. He just wanted to, that's how he won. He wanted to be out on the shield and finished.
Call it foolish, call it brave, maybe both, but impressive.
And I still, oh sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was like, I'm still like intrigued by what Wilder can do after this. I mean, unless he's completely washed from this fight or mentally he can't come back from this, like both of you have mentioned earlier, there's still so many of those fun fights out there. Him and Joshua would be awesome, because I think he would have a much better chance against Joshua than he would, you know, than he does against Fury, just styles and style, everything else for that matter. Him and Andy Ruiz, other guys in the PBC world. Usyk would be fascinating to see. There's, you know, Wilder sticks around.
I was just going to say, it was interesting to me that Fury's approach to this fight made it a lot harder for him, because it was like every time he jabbed, he completely disrupted Wilder. Wilder could not throw the right hand. He was totally off balance. I mean, he looks like he's the circus guy on stilts anyway, except he's on an ice rink, like at the best of times. But the jab was so effective, so disruptive. And Fury didn't really use it that much. Like, and he was landing it with intensity. Like, he was driving in with it. I mean, it was just this kind of lance that he was sticking out there. But the other was, is that Wilder did this thing for the last three rounds where he was circling to Fury's right hand. And Fury kept trying to throw a straight right hand, but not like a looping right hand, which seemed tailor-made to catch Wilder as he kept doing this awkward circle on stilts sort of thing. So I was just wondering, like, if you don't have the energy to throw flurries, why don't you just rely on your jab to just tear him apart? Because it takes away the danger of his right hand, and it's an effective tool at just destroying this guy, pummeling him. But he didn't really rely on it. He wanted to do these pouncing with a few awkward flurries, all of which were too smothered to really do any real damage almost every time. So I just thought tactically, like, if I'm in his corner, it's like this jab is working, it's hurting him, and it's preventing him from using his only real hammer to cause you danger. And yet they kept moving away to other things that were just not working. And the smothering, even when it would work occasionally, land something of significance, he would keep Wilder up and allow him to rejuvenate. So it's kind of a weird game plan. I mean, it made it very exciting, but it seemed unnecessarily exciting from the perspective of Fury strategically trying to take this guy out.
Sugar Hill was, I think, especially yelling at him in the corner to make sure, use your jab, like, what are you doing? So, bring to your point, absolutely. And when Fury did use his jab, he was much more successful in avoiding Wilder's stuff. But you know, Fury has those multiple layers to him where he tries to, he's like, okay, I got my size, I'm just going to wear him the fuck out. And that's what he tried to do for there. I mean, to an extent, it's very dangerous because that's when he was moving in to do it. So a couple of times he left himself open. That's why he was able to get clocked the way he did. But had he was, you know, but that's how he kind of does it. He can either try to outbox you, or if he's just going to be really big like that, he's going to lean all over you and just maul you to death.
When he didn't have the defense he did in the second fight, he didn't have the head movement. He wasn't as twitchy. Like, it was a very different Fury. It was not not as sort of complex with as much dimension in what he was doing to disrupt Wilder. Like, he was much more basic in this fight.
His angles were not the same. No. He wasn't using his feet and his legs the same way. There's no question. And I think actually Aris, I think that he kind of nailed it with his response. It seemed that, I don't know if it was just in Tyson Fury's head that he thought that this was what he needed to do, but perhaps it was like a psychological thing as well. But it was like he was trying to be the bigger man, trying to be the stronger guy, almost like as if he was trying to say, that added weight you put on, I'm still going to push you around. Like, I'm still going to lean on you. I'm still going to do this shit to you. And don't mistake that kind of stuff for great infighting, because it's not. That's not really infighting. It's just kind of stymieing the fight. It's not really doing anything inside, like doing damage, but nonetheless
too.
Exactly. It's effective.
It's so hard to push all that off him. And while they're carrying that extra weight too, not trying to do that, it's not going to help him. He's not a guy that's already in for that. Like Fury too, both of these mentioned earlier how relaxed Fury was. Fury is just relaxed and leaning on him and doing what he wants. Wilder is still tense while trying to deal with this and trying to wiggle out and get stuffed and and he's not a good infighter, so he can't, you know, he's not known for his massive uppercuts and like digging in with body shots and hooks and things.
Yeah.
So Fury was just over there and just leaning, wow, all that nasty sweat, heavy thing, and just, well, like, you know,
smelling like cold cuts. And
I mean, at one point, Russell Moore shoves him away, right? And you just see him grab Fury's tit, and it just goes up like that. And just, I'm just like, oh, God.
oh, my God, dude. That's hilarious. Now that's
all just mashed together, and just I'm just like, oh, man, let's put a shirt on, bro.
It's a Russ Meyer flick, an unintentional Russ Meyer flick. Now, I think that you nailed it, dude. That's exactly what he was trying to do, was just be physical and stuff like that. And I think that it obviously worked, but it put him in danger and wound up getting him caught a few times because of what I was talking about, that it's not infighting, that it's a lot of the time he's leaning in and he's just kind of has his arms out and stuff like that. Man, heavyweights of yesteryear would have eaten that shit alive. Like, you know, just leaning forward for the, like, to clutch or to clinch, take a step back and throw an uppercut. You know what I mean?
Like,
it would have been like Lennox Lewis would have fucking had a field day with that kind of shit. Mm-hmm. But, you know, one thing that Tyson Fury exhibited was balls. That's right. Clean shaven balls. I got to go ahead and give a shout out, because support for the Knuckles and Gloves podcast is brought to you by Manscaped. Okay, look, man, I can't confirm. I've only heard rumors, okay? I'm only saying what I've heard. And I've heard that Tyson Fury might possibly, maybe, ostensibly, in theory, use the Manscaped, or the Manscaped Lawnmower 4.0. You know why? Because it's cordless. It allows you a little light for you to actually trim your balls. You can adjust the length. And when you show your balls like that in a heavyweight fight, you want them to be smooth shaved. So if you do want smooth shaped balls, here's what you got to do. You go to manscaped.com and you use our unique code GLOVE, GLOVE, and you get 20% off your order plus free shipping. That's right, dude. Free shipping, 20% off if you use our code GLOVE, GLOVE. And then you can have smooth, fresh shaved balls, just like possibly the heavyweight champion Tyson Fury. So unlock your confidence and always use the right tools for the job with Manscaped. You heard that right.
Patrick, I had a question. I mean, I heard this could be apocryphal, but I heard that Kovalev was somebody who was a little bit on the fence with using Manscaped. And that was part of the reason why Andre Ward, in this very controversial finish, went low, using his own Manscaped right fist to do what needed to be done to that Russian wilderness.
look, when you got sponsors and you're loyal, you'll do anything for that brand. And that includes almost, you know, coming within a nut hair of imploding a light heavyweight title fight by going low. Look, man, you can't be having these non-Manscaped folks around. I get it. I get it.
I mean, because some people thought that Ward, you know, was trying to take advantage of something. I don't think people have appreciated the manscaping angle of that closing out performance.
Yeah, get corporate for a moment. You know, just get corporate for a moment and understand this. Poor Eris is over here during this.
Well, I mean, the other thing that I think we have to talk about is Wilder with the bleeding of the ear is, you know, the unsightly ear. That's a problem that I believe Manscaped looks after, not just if there's bleeding that needs to be mopped up, but if there's unsightly hair there in the nostrils.
Right. Well, you're unlikely to collect blood in the ear or nostril if you keep that hair tightly groomed like you can when you order their nose and ear hair trimmers from manscaped.com. You could easily get 20% off if you use our code GLOVE.
I'm going to do it, and I'm going to talk to Mark Breland, and he's going to do it too. Because who I blame for that loss is Mark Breland.
That's right. And that would be the ultimate. After all the ball showing last night, and then, you know, go to directly to Mark Breland. Oh, buddy, come on. That's the revenge of a lifetime.
Just you know, get him ready for some action at 55 years old. He's an Olympic gold medalist.
Yeah, Eris over here getting the embarrassment of a lifetime. So go to manscaped.com and get a deal of a lifetime by using our code GLOVE. Get 20% off, free shipping. Anyway, back to the actual boxing. Anybody who's listening through this, I bless you. I don't know what's wrong with you, but bless you. Look, dude, it was a really great fight last night. I guess my question would be, I started off with the hyperbole, and I was being serious, but revisiting that shit. There's already talk, you know, people are comparing the fight last night to great fights of yesteryear and stuff like that. We don't need to make a definitive list or anything, but where do you think this fight falls in? You know, I don't think that it was as great as like a Foreman Lyle. Obviously, that was just kind of like almost nonstop, just like brawling. It wasn't on the level of an Ollie Frazier 3, were again just kind of like nonstop sloppy older guys, but nonstop brutality. But I mean, it's not too far below those kinds of fights, I don't think.
I think it's going to depend on. I just think it's going to depend on how we regard this era of heavyweights. Is this a new golden era in terms of, you know, Joshua, Fury, Wilder, now Usyk is kind of this wild card. You know, just similarly to, you know, is Ken Norton an all-time great? You know, like Ron Lyle, is he an all-time great? They produce some great fights with some great fighters, but are they themselves great? And I think the same is going to be asked of Deontay Wilder is if he walked away, should he be in the Hall of Fame for the career he's had? Do you think?
A lot of people will vote for him.
And a lot of people,
I will, but I already know that much.
But a lot of people would say, yeah, like, I mean, you were losing to Ortiz twice and you took him out. And then three times you lost handily to Fury. Is Fury an all-time great? I mean, like, I saw some people raising that specter. Maybe. But, I mean, would Lennox Lewis have had any trouble with this era of heavyweights? Like, wouldn't have Lewis just fucking mocked all of these guys? Probably. I think he would. I mean, he had the tools to do it. Both of these guys look completely gassed after two rounds, let's remember, in this fight in a way that, like, you would never see Lewis. I mean, I think the most exciting fight that Lewis ever produced was when he was kind of over the hill and fought Klitschko. There's so many back and forths in that, and he showed so much that we really hadn't seen before. But I mean, it's interesting just in terms of where do you evaluate this era in order to assess the quality of this fight in terms of just itself, separate from context. It was such an exciting, dramatic fight because of the styles and what we saw put on display and how much was unexpected. But in terms of historically, how important are these fighters? It's a different question that I think is interesting, but they're kind of separate questions and yet they do have some overlap.
What do you think, Eris?
Well, I agree in the fact that I think it's a notch below Ali Frazier 3, Ali Frazier 1, Foreman Lyle, for that matter. There's certain degrees over here, you know, Norton Holmes, but it holds its place, I think, as an all-time great heavyweight scrap just for what happened in the fight, the dramatic appeal of it, the implication of it being a trilogy, the definitive fight of it, the definitive finale, what happened, you know, with Fury almost getting knocked the fuck out a couple of times. Like, so much dramatic stuff that it's already probably going to be known as the fight of the year. And so it holds its weight. A lot of people are going to remember it. People are talking about it from now, and it's talking that it's going to be one of those fights that they're, you know, going to talk about from years from now. And absolutely, it probably is. Because the heavyweight division, as fun as it can be and as, you know, much we love it and stuff like that, it doesn't produce fights like this all the time. For every great, crazy, wild brawl that you get, there's a lot of pedestrian, boring ones that go through the motions or just, you know, one-sided, whatever it may be. So when something like this happens, everyone gets a little bit more excited. It feels a little bit more, you know, at home about it or whatever, like, take it to their heart. But it holds its own place. I'm not, you know, probably in the top 10 at one point. I'm not sure if it's going to be in the top. Obviously not top 5 for me, but I think it holds its place in history. I'm not sure where these guys are going to particularly end up in history after their careers are over. I think Fury's still going to continue from here and see what else his legacy can, you know, go with. I want to consider him an all-time great already, like a lot of people are hailing or saying that he's one of the, you know, top 10 best heavyweights. That's a big thing to say. And considering the history of the division, who's been there in the past, he's not there yet, all right? Is he very impressive? Has he had the makings of a Hall of Famer eventually? Sure, I could. Most definitely. He has the resume, and what he's overcome and what he's able to do since coming back has been incredible. But I'm not sure he's quite there yet. Wilder is another one. He's a wild card. I'm not sure if I would ever vote for him in the Hall of Fame. He's had an interesting career, a very exciting career. But again, this is not the strongest era of heavyweights that we've ever seen. You know, this is like, compared to the 90s, which I consider maybe the second or third best era ever, it's nothing even there. But I will say this, things are getting very exciting again. With the finish of this fight, Usyk coming into the picture now, and a lot of other things coming into place. So the division has a lot of potential. I'm very excited to see where it goes, but I'm not quite sure if how these guys are going to be looked at in history compared to other greats, just because of the era that they were in. Almost like Klitschko. It's like Klitschko, you know, back in the day, especially when he was in his prime, knocking everybody out left and right. That was not a good era. It wasn't very exciting. You know, he was just a dominant champion. Anytime he fought, no one really gave the challenger a chance. And as with Lennox before him too, as the years go on, people are getting more and more appreciative of him. And I think that's the same thing probably will happen to these guys, if, depending on how their careers end.
I also wonder if Deontay Wilder, if he has a couple losses to a shitty fighter, not even a shitty fighter, an average fighter, he's going to become our kind of Michael Grant in a way. You know, Michael Grant, I remember the magazines coming out when Michael Grant was on the way up. He's got the same, he's got a Tyson's manager. It was so like you, the way he was marketed. He's gigantic. He's not even a modern heavyweight. He's the future of what heavyweights will be, which is where we are now. Now all these guys are this size. They're all giants. And Michael Grant fundamentally just couldn't fight. He was a big, strong guy. But look what Lewis did to him. And I suspect Lewis would have done the same thing to Wilder.
Well, look at Alexander Usyk just a couple weeks ago with Anthony Joshua, demonstrating that he himself is not tiny. He's like 6'2", 6'3", but nonetheless, he's more of a quote unquote normal sized heavyweight, and demonstrated that you don't need to be giant sized in order to succeed or be very good. And then in the case of, you know, Michael Grant, I think that that's again showing that there's a big difference between big and good, as we know. And so in order to give an intelligent, complex answer to what I was asking, you know, where does that fight last night fit in history? And you do need to kind of assess where these guys, where these two fighters fit into the division historically and stuff like that. So when you go get into the question of like, well, would you vote him into the Hall of Fame or something? It sucks because it's so, that kind of like the credentials are deceptive, especially with like Deontay Wilder, where if I were to say, just predicting, you know, if I were to say, no, I wouldn't vote Deontay Wilder into the Hall of Fame, at least not right now, you know, not with what he has under his belt, somebody could ostensibly say, well, what do you mean? He made X amount of defenses of the heavyweight title, where it's kind of like, well, that's not, no, not totally true. He didn't make, you know, he didn't defend the heavyweight title. He got a belt, got a belt from Bermain Stiverne. And
I think the other factor is that his handlers seem, in hindsight, very cognizant of his liabilities and the way that they were protecting him. And again, if you put Michael Grant, the same resume that Wilder had, and let Michael Grant face all those guys, you probably would have had a pretty similar result. Because what are those definitive victories on Wilder's career? There aren't any. And the moment he stepped up to fight a 67-year-old Cuban, he had massive problems. I mean, he was very close to being knocked out in the first fight. In the second fight, he was losing it, but closed the show, to his credit. Both of those fights, he closed the show. But he had big problems. If he fought Ortiz 10 times, he's probably going to lose three of those.
Well, and he had actually, there were a couple fights before that, too, where he had gotten either wobbled, hurt pretty good, lost a few rounds. I think it was Eric Molina was the one who wobbled him real good. Yeah. And I don't remember if he knocked him down.
He escaped a tough fight, too. Then,
who?
Was it Duhapis? Johan
Duhaupaw.
Yeah.
And then also, what was that other dude? Arthur Spilka. Yeah, he gave him a damn good fight too and hurt him before he got absolutely fucking laid out for it. But still, I think that he had clearly shown some shortcomings and beyond the eye test, because the eye test demonstrated to anybody who's had any experience viewing boxing that he's clearly, like I said earlier to Aris, I think before we started recording, he's a very free swinging puncher. Yeah. He's very, you know, he's not a straight orthodox type of puncher. And so I just kind of, there's so many kind of small tweaks from last night. Like if he were a little bit more orthodox puncher, maybe he wouldn't have gotten a chance to land those punches. But if he were, or if he had the ability to just settle down a little bit instead of going nuts after Tyson Fury, giving Tyson Fury that opportunity to reach in and grab instead of just stepping back and firing a really straight right hand down the middle or something, might have had a totally different result. But
well, and what he's got though is not just the one superpower. I think after this fight, we have to say he's got two superpowers. Is his resilience, his determination was epic in that fight, as it was in the second fight. It was epic. And that if he didn't have that, this would have been over in the third round easily. Like we've seen a lot of guys who are regarded as warriors who would have given up way before Deontay Wilder. And for all of the annoyance with the excuses in the second fight and this bravado of I want to go out on my shield, he lived up to it. So now we can't just be like, oh, he was full of shit and this is posturing. He absolutely wanted that. And you do have to give him some credit for it, because he's going to have to deal with the results of that for the rest of his life, as will his family. And with Fury, I mean, I think Fury would have given, I love that little highlight they showed of Emmanuel Stewart, where he was talking about the two great fighters of the next era, and that it was both of these guys, which was really interesting to hear him. I think it was from 9 years ago, and just saying that Fury was far and away like the best, just in terms of no fear, how tough he was and the tools he had. I don't think Ali would have had a super easy time with Fury. Fury would be difficult for anybody to face, even though I know he hasn't always looked great. You know, I think there were a lot of questions about him coming into the first Wilder fight and stuff like that. Same with Klitschko. I mean, that wasn't a very pretty fight. That was not a rewatchable fight when he beat Klitschko, but he did it, full credit to him. But when Fury's at his best, and I think like that's the interesting thing about Fury, a bit like Ali too, is when Ali didn't take guys seriously, he didn't look great against a lot of guys that were not all-time greats. But when he was at his absolute best, we saw such greatness when we were looking for it. And I think Fury has that quality too. I mean, if Fury was able to really focus himself, if he wasn't battling mental health issues, if he didn't have a body that came down from 350 pounds, like these are not intangibles. These are directly giving you the result that you're seeing, is that he's got a lot of wear and tear on that body. He has been dropped a number of times. He's taken some punishment, but when we're looking for greatness from fights, he shows us greatness, I think, unlike anybody in the era. And I think like these three fights, can you think of a series of fights that are screaming to be made into legendary nights more than this trilogy? Is there anything close to this that have happened in the last 25 years where you go, no, that one needs to be ahead of this one? Not even close. This would be a fabulous legendary nights. It would be probably more interesting because the characters are more interesting than Holyfield and Bo, right? Like, I mean, that's another aspect about this is these characters are much more interesting people in a lot of ways in terms of how they clash than Bo and Holyfield did. Taking nothing away from them, but I mean, nobody's really dying to read the autobiography of Riddick Bowe or the biography of Riddick Bowe or Holyfield. They were never really marketable personalities. Tyson Fury, it's shocking that he's not bigger in the US. It's shocking. He's such an interesting character. Good and bad.
Last night partying. You know, just the command that he had in the club. Yeah, him and Joseph Parker were there partying at a rave in Vegas at some club with the standing on stage shirtless and dancing away.
I haven't seen it.
It's pretty hilarious, yeah. Imagine you just went through 11 rounds of hell and now you're out dancing and partying. It sounds like what I think Joe Frazier or something like that was doing after one of his fights with Ali.
It's brutal shit, man. And, you know, he's a fine entertainer. That's for sure. He grabs the microphone just as he's done with his interview. And one more thing, you know, fucking starts singing to the crowd. It's great shit. You know, it's a throwback to Rinty Monaghan, old flyweight champion from Belfast, who used to sing to the crowd after just about every fight. I think that's another thing about Tyson Fury. There are things about Tyson Fury that are unlikable or that are a turnoff, just as there are about Deontay Wilder. But one of the things about Tyson Fury that I do appreciate is even if it's kind of only surface level, even if it's only a bit of a veneer for the showmanship, he does seem to kind of he pays some heed. He pays some respect to fighters from yesteryear, even if it's only in homage, even if it's only in kind of mimicking many of the things that they used to do or the things they used to say. Grabbing the microphone and talking a bunch of shit to the crowd and going up to the crowd that's booing them and flipping them all off and stuff like that, heckling the crowd. It's very entertaining, and it is surprising that he's not a bigger star in the US. But I think that it's also, it might be difficult for a lot of people to kind of reconcile being a bigger fan or the star or whatever with him not being as flashy or not being a big puncher and stuff like that as a heavyweight. So, I mean, I guess the question becomes now, where does Tyson Fury go? I mean, realistically, it probably sounds like he's probably going to like take a little bit of a break. I would, after not only a fight like that, but concluding that series. He was expecting a fight with Anthony Joshua, and then he winds up having to go to court and being forced to fight Deontay Wilder for a third time, where, you know, from his perspective, you're forced to fight this guy for a third time that you feel you took care of definitively the second time. You know, in your mind, you're saying, there's no need for this. Why are we even doing this? This guy's scared, whatever. And then he's forced to fight him again and is on the verge of just totally putting this thing to bed in the third round with pretty much, you know, no damage taken, and then winds up having to fucking go through hell over the next handful of rounds. I mean, I would imagine he's going to be taking a little bit of a break, both from the perspective of getting that damage, but also probably just being tired, you know, being aggravated by having to go through that instead of the massive money fight in the UK with Anthony Joshua that's for now been put on the back burner. But what do you guys think is going to happen with these two guys? Aris, what do you think is going to happen?
Well, with Fury, I think his next fight, he's obligated to fight Dillian White, unless White somehow, you know, loses to Otto Wallin in his upcoming fight, which is very possible. And from there, I would assume that if he's able to, I guess try to find, you know, figure out the winner between Usyk and the rematch between Usyk and Joshua. And then from there, you know, hopefully make the giant super fight for the undisputed title for all of them against the winner of that fight. So that's where I think Fury's going to end up going. He doesn't seem like a guy that's just going to take like easy title defenses or whatever. Not like the one he was doing when he was during the quarantine period when he just made a couple of comebacks. But like at this point now, or earlier, excuse me. And for this fight now that he's at this type of level, like before when he had the first fight with Wilder, you know, he took a couple of interim fights, but now he's almost to the point now where he's such like a superstar and commands so much and being the king of the division. I think he only wants the biggest fights. So with that being said, I don't, you know, I see him, just like I just said, waiting for the winner of Usyk Joshua after this, after he has to get through his mandatory. As far as Wilder goes, it's very interesting. You know, there's a lot of different ways Wilder can go. Obviously, this is a big setback for him, but he's still one of the biggest players in the division. He's still one of the biggest names in boxing. So I think he needs a long rest. Obviously, he just took a massive beating again. For mentally and physically, he just needs to figure out where he wants to go in his career, if he can still do this, if he still wants to do this, or whatever could happen. And then when he comes back, I'm sure it's going to be in the PBC realm for a little bit. Maybe, you know, Hellenius had a big win, so I could see that potentially happening. You know, Andy Ruiz is probably a big fight that I think that the PBC would probably try to, like, you know, build together. So I can see that happening for a little bit before he can try to vault himself into the other picture, because it's that is going to be busy. Wilder doesn't need quite in that right now, because all those guys are going to be tied up. If Fury is going to be moving in that direction, he's done with Wilder. So Wilder at this point now is going to, you know, there's a lot of heavyweights in the PBC bubble that he could potentially be matched with and can make for exciting fights with. So if he comes back, that's where I see him at.
That's true. That's one thing that PBC has done pretty well, is they've kind of stocked up on opponents for a lot of their bigger fighters or bigger stars. And they've gotten a number of heavyweights over the years that have kind of, like, you know, gone, they're good for those backup opponent kind of roles. Bryn, what do you think happens with these guys?
I would love to see Joshua and Wilder fight. I just think stylistically that would be tremendous. And I think, like, maybe they have two or three fights in them. I mean, like, stylistically, I think they're kind of not more interesting, but I mean, it could be a Lyle Foreman too, in a different sort of way than this was, because Joshua is just a little more limited than Fury in a way that I think Wilder could take more advantage of. It's a little bit more of an even contest. And, you know, I think Joshua has more stamina issues that just make him more nervous, more cautious, that Wilder could play the boss a little more. But it would also give Joshua the opportunity, if he wants to meet that and try to be the boss himself, like maybe take a cue from what Fury did. So in any event, like whatever permutation it goes, I think like they're all interesting, which is great. I would love to see Usyk Fury. I don't know how Usyk can overcome the physicality of Fury, especially if Fury comes into that really in shape. And I'd love to see Fury Joshua, but I think Fury wins that probably easier than he did against Wilder, because I just think, I think his style is so wrong for Joshua. Joshua, just what we saw against Usyk, where it's such a smaller guy. And granted, I think Usyk fought a brilliant fight. I think he's extraordinarily talented. And also, like Fury, not wasting any energy with nerves, with fear, with the big stage, with a crowd that is not for him, doesn't make any difference to him at all. He's a happy fighter. He's a happy warrior. And it's, you know, I think Mike Tyson said that there's nothing more dangerous than a happy fighter. And both Fury and Usyk have that. And I think they would almost look forward to a great struggle in the ring. Whereas I feel like Joshua and Wilder, I don't think they have that attitude. Even though I think Wilder proved he's a great warrior, it takes some energy to get into the mindset of being the killer he wants to be perceived as. Whereas for Fury, it's just second nature. And I think for Usyk too, Usyk just looks like a killer. And I remember like being in a boxing gym once when I was a teenager, and Oleg Taktarov, I don't know if you remember him from the MMA.
That dude was a beast.
Yeah, he was a beast. And he walked into the gym. Scary. He was the scariest human being that I've ever been in a room with. And I've spent time with Tyson a number of times and a number of boxers. And I'm not saying that they don't have their own energy to own a room, but I've never been in a room with anything like Oleg Taktarov. And I just remember when he looked at you, it was the equivalent. I've never had anybody point a gun at me, but it felt like that. It felt like somebody was pointing a loaded weapon at my face when he was just looking. And he was totally polite. He was not trying to be tough or anything like that. It's just the energy he brought was, I've killed a number of people. And I remember like the late James Gandolfini saying in True Romance, like the first time you kill somebody, it's hard to get over it. At this point, I just kill people to watch their expression change. Takhtarov had that kind of energy where it was just so mundane what he was doing in life, like just brutalizing people and separating them from their consciousness. And Usyk has a bit of that energy. There's something scary about him because he's so like almost amused by what he's doing. He's not trying to be tough, but it's like, oh, Anthony Joshua, okay, I'll just fucking dismantle and humiliate you. No problem, on to the next thing. I'm just, you know, counting the money I'm making, and I'm just a happy warrior who's just going to hopscotch through the heavyweight division of these giants and just fucking just disarm all of them, wipe the floor with all of them, even though you say they're so special. I could never do this as a cruiserweight. Okay, well, look, what do you know about boxing? What do you know about my pedigree? What do you know about what I'm capable of doing? I'll show you. And he goes out and does it so matter-of-factly. So I still kind of have this weird feeling that Usyk might beat all of them in a goofy way, but I would love to see Usyk have a chance with the, you know, with, I'd love to see him against Wilder too. I mean, wouldn't that be an interesting fight?
Oh, God. Usyk Wilder would be awesome because yeah. I think Wilder would lose every second of the fight, but then again, all he has to do is land one of those wild punches on him and he has the potential to do it because he could throw them off balance whenever he needs to with something then. Usyk, as good as he is defensively, isn't, you know, he can be touched up sometimes. So, yeah, Wilder has the potential to tag him. The Fury, yeah. It's extremely fascinating to me, too. Just because Fury has so many different ways of, like, Usyk could be outboxed, and Fury realizes, okay, this ain't going to work, and starts that mauling shit with him. And how's Usyk going to deal with that, considering how he looked against Chisora? Like, it's fascinating to think about.
And we've already seen that Papachenko style is vulnerable against an infighter and against somebody who's going to be mauling. We saw that very quickly with Orlando Salido. So I don't know, but I got to say, dude, you get these other fighters after a fight like that. And they're like, they're posting like selfies and they're like burp, 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 in the hospital and shit. And then you get Usyk after that fight and he's just like with a fucking like drink and he's like, hey, you know, he didn't give a shit, bro. Hey, that guy is a psychotic bastard and he loves it. He loves fighting. And that alone is the kind of quality that's like you said, that's dangerous, man. Eris, you said, it sounds like based on Big Daddy Bunce, he tweeted yesterday that it had been confirmed that Dillian White, well, or the winner of Dillian White against Otto Vilene was going to be fighting Tyson Fury or in line to fight Tyson Fury. But he worded it as Dillian White is fighting Tyson Fury next. And I was like, hey, wait a second, dude. Otto Vilene's going to be fighting this guy at the end of the month. So I guess it's just my way of, you know, butting in and plugging the fact that I interviewed Otto Vilene last week on the podcast. He was pretty nice dude. Gave some pretty cool answers and a little bit of insight as far as how he got into the game and stuff like that. But point being that adding him to the mix of this heavyweight division, it's definitely not the 60s and 70s. It's definitely not the 90s in terms of quality, but it can be fun and it's okay if it's entertaining, but not super high quality. And that appears to be what we have here and what we've had for a few years. It was just that the pandemic kind of put a massive pause on a lot of the things that were happening, unfortunately. And have already demonstrated that now kind of we're not out of the pandemic, but we're now at least in a position where we can start making these fights. And now that we have started making them again, we're seeing that they're high quality. They're good fighters. They're putting on good fights and they're evenly matched. So I hope that we get to see more and more of these fights. The fights that you guys brought up, you know, Usyk against either of these guys, I think is extremely intriguing. Usyk kind of going inside the shots of Wilder and getting inside where he's kind of out of danger, definitely potential there. Or, you know, getting clipped trying to get inside. Usyk, you know, trying to box with Tyson Fury or having to get inside and seeing what he can do inside with body punching and shit like that. And there's a lot of different possibilities here. And anyway, that fight last night, it was a tremendous fight. And off the heels of that, dude, it's like a high, you know, it's a keeps going.
I couldn't go to sleep for a while after last night. Couldn't. I was hyped.
And Bryn, you didn't say earlier, did you get to watch it at the theater?
I did. No, I saw it. I went, I biked over to Brooklyn. I biked over the Brooklyn Bridge and biked home. And just as you say, I got home at 2:30.
It's like that scene in Mike Tyson's Punch Out, you know?
a little bit, except it's a fucking city bike. So I'm on a granny bike, you know, which is, I think the hardest way to look cool in the universe is like, there's all these people out partying in Manhattan as I'm driving through on a ceiling, you know, beep, 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 like this. Ding, 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 ding. Yeah, just like granny. But no, I was just turning it over as I was coming home. And, you know, these fights are interesting when you're sort of imagining, you know, I spent 2 days with Deontay Wilder. I really liked him as a person, and yet his showmanship turns me against him as a fighter. But I was just thinking, huh, I met his wife, met his team. These are people that were with him since he first started boxing. And you're just like, I wonder what tomorrow is going to be like, that this is how it went. And there's no way to change how this went, even though you were so close a number of times. And same with the second fight and the first fight, you know, how this is going to define the rest of your life. Cause you kind of feel like this is going to go on forever, that you're always going to be this character, and you're on the way up and you're undefeated. And suddenly now your whole career can only be seen through the lens of this trilogy. And do you want to just let it go and move on to another thing? Or do you want to try to recapture it? But do you still have the same confidence now that you've had this just happen to you yesterday, like drop on your head? It's interesting. Same with Fury. Is Fury going to be able to maintain the same discipline that he was able to muster to come back for that second fight? Well, he didn't do it in the third fight. He was a little different and not better. He's still a great champion, but he was not as good as he was in the second fight. And I just wonder, is he going to be able to maintain the focus? Again, he probably thinks it's going to go on forever. He said at the beginning of the fight, I can just train for 2 or 3 weeks and I'm ready to go. No, you can't. And it's only going to get harder as you get older, as the injuries rack up, as training gets a little harder, as recovery gets a little harder.
Boar meat gets more scarce.
Yeah. And more opponents are getting younger and younger, and everybody wants a piece of your fame, your celebrity, by knocking you off the hill. So I just found myself at 2:30 in the morning turning this over as I'm biking over the bridge, coming back home. And I haven't had that feeling after watching a fight for a long time. I think the last time I felt it, and I felt some comparisons going into this fight, was Lewis Tyson, where I kind of thought, if Tyson can do this, he can kind of recapture his whole legacy, his whole narrative. There's like this huge redemption component, but there's no way he can do it. Maybe he can do it. Like, I felt like you're just battling yourself with it. Come on, like there has to be some way at 36 he can do this. And then just gets fucking pulverized. And I was in Spain at like 4 o'clock in the morning watching that fight. And I was so miserable walking home after seeing that. But my childhood hero just demolished by this guy. And of course, Tyson was never the same. That was the clear moment where everybody woke up, that all of the marketing that he was doing and the people around him, no, he's better than ever. He's better than ever. No, he's not. And he hasn't been better since he was 20 years old and beat Michael Spinks. That's where the downhill slope began. When you thought it was the beginning of something, it's like Michael Jackson with Thriller. It's just beginning this career. He's just a kid. No, it's not. It's actually the beginning of the end. And that, it's interesting when that happens to you, when you're confronted with it. You think it's one thing and it's the opposite.
You know, I brought it up on the preview show. I don't want to like drag down the mood, but I do think it's worth talking about again. I brought it up on the preview show. So in the late 1930s, early 1940s, we had Mike Jacobs in the 20th Century Boxing Club. Mike Jacobs more or less controlled Joe Louis, therefore controlled the heavyweight title, therefore commanded a shitload of money, basically, and attention, controlled the most powerful publicly man in the world, essentially. Now, obviously, things changed. Mike Jacobs winds up having, I think it was a stroke, And then that opened the door, if the door wasn't already very clearly open, for mob figures like Frankie Carbo to ease their way on in, start the International Boxing Club of New York, and bring things to a point where essentially the mob controlled the heavyweight championship and several other titles, the welterweight title, eventually got their hands on the middleweight title, light heavyweights, etc. So I'm not saying that this is the same situation. I'm not. However, it bears repeating, and it bears another, even if it's just a brief discussion. Now MTK and Daniel Kinahan more or less control the heavyweight title. Daniel Kinahan being the advisor slash manager of Tyson Fury and several other fighters. It was suggested recently that he's also advising Terrence Crawford, one of the pound for pound best fighters in the world. Well, a whole bunch of fighters. So again, to repeat, I'm not saying it's the same situation, but we once again have a figure who has been linked to a lot of mob activity, linked to the heavyweight championship. What do we think about that?
Well, I think the big difference that you're avoiding here, which is unfortunate given the shirt you're wearing, is that these guys are Manscaped. And you look back in the 1930s, that guy was definitely
it's not impossible. Manscaped. Couldn't have been.
It's impossible. And I mean, also
technology wasn't there yet.
It wasn't there. Some unsightly nose and ear hair. And could that stroke have been linked potentially to some sexual rejection on the basis of a kind of wilderness that he was offering? Possibly, maybe, probably. So I mean, as much as you want to, you know, look at this dark underbelly and resurgence of criminality, the bright side of it is, at least from the perspective of their sexual partners, it's Manscaped.
I appreciate you pivoting this really awkward criminal conversation into both an advertising and comedic opportunity.
Well, criminality can be a great enticement to people. I'm not judging. I mean, we're just wired to where we are in terms of what turns us on. And again, I just, you know, everybody wants to focus on the negative of just organized crime taking over boxing and you know.
There's opportunity there. There's financial opportunity.
There's financial opportunity, but I'm just speaking strictly in this parochial way to the sexual partners of these criminals, that at least, you know, they have a beeline to what they're looking for that's not obstructed by any kind of foliage or wilderness or what have you.
Free to explore.
Thanks to Manscaped. 4.0 kit. I'm ordering it.
But it's a serious question.
No, I think it's fucking terrible. I think it's really evil what they're doing. And at the same time, like, I've had a number of people close to me, like boxing circle people, say, hey, do you want to do a big investigative documentary about it? No, I don't, because I'm not going to get killed for like $2,000 to go off and launch into it. Like it's just risk versus reward. This is, I'm not Woodward and Bernstein in terms of, you know, Ben Bradley backing me to go after it. But I mean, it's not that I'm not interested in it because it's not a great story or an important story within the world of boxing. I mean, you know, when I was in Ireland covering Ringan Diao fighting an opponent who was linked to organized crime, like our van was like robbed. And we were threatened with like him getting killed. And I've had the same thing going to Tijuana for a fight with Ringan Diao, where his manager was told, if you guys cross into Tijuana, you're going to be murdered, kidnapped, or have drugs planted on you. It's not fun. It's not a fun element of covering the sport. Like, so I've always wished that boxing would clean itself up, but it, you know, there's no barrier to entry. So it allows, you know, somebody like me, where I got a credential and I had no business getting it. It let me in, but it lets in a lot of other people too that are equally undesirable, you know, or more so.
What do you think, Aris? I mean, there's that historic element there of kind of precedent.
In terms of the organized crime going on?
Yeah, like in the supposed connection with Kinahan.
Yeah, you know, it's tough, man. A lot of, like Brent just mentioned, a lot of people would be really, you know, not looking to take on that type of case and the implications that can come with it. It's really dangerous. It's crazy. But, you know, there were writers from the past who probably would have been very open to an assignment like that, like the late, great Jack Newfield, for example, who did a deep dive on Don King and his ties to organized crime and everything else basically in that book that he wrote in the 90s about him. And that was a really, really big eye-opener in terms of how boxing was run with organized crime and what was going on in that time period and King's connections with it that I hadn't even known about and probably wasn't really, people weren't aware of since like the days of Frankie Carbo, Blinky Palermo, and so on and so forth. So it's like, you know, it's bad in the fact that like more people don't talk about it, and it seems like especially the major writers who should probably, instead of just brushing it off and not thinking twice about it, or instead of, you know, actually knowing this guy's background and kind of ignoring it and talking about how great of a manager he is or how influential he is or whatever at XYZ, more people I think would be interesting if they called it for what it is. But this is boxing, this is writers, these are, you know, a lot of people are, well, a lot of the current writers today, at least, you know, the younger people and stuff like that are more interested, it seems, in terms of level, like trying to make sure that they keep all their friends afloat and trying not to, like, you know, burn any bridges instead of like writing what's actually going on out there.
Well, and they're also you're also not getting paid to do it. You know, yeah. Like that's the other
thing.
I mean, 95% of the writers that are attending events are attending it for credential. They're not getting paid to be there, or if they are getting paid, it's nothing. So
yeah, like the trip is paid or something like that, but that's, they're not really getting money from it.
Yeah. I mean, if you're Mark Cram covering boxing for Sports Illustrated, you know, like he was afraid of flying and he expensed taking an ocean liner to Europe for fucking events. We'll try to get an expense account. I mean, I remember Andre Ward saying that to me when I went out to Oakland to cover him. Oh, why aren't there more writers like you who are going to spend 5 days with me? I'm like, well, there's a ton of writers like me that want to spend 5 days with you. Nobody's willing to pay them to go do it. They won't pay their airfare. They won't give them a hotel to stay in. Like, it's, do you know what any writers actually earn, Andre? Have you ever asked them? Have you ever, like, what's your assumption of what they're earning? And he had no idea, because why would you have an idea if you're in them? So you're going to risk your life to bring down organized crime's involvement in boxing, where everybody is worth millions. Okay, I mean, good luck. But I mean, Woodward and Bernstein had the second most powerful newspaper in the United States in the 70s, where like newspapers were incredibly powerful. Whereas like, you know, the Iraq War, the New York Times fucking cheerleaded it. You know, cheerleaded weapons of mass destruction. Well, why did they do that? Well, because nobody was really held accountable for it when they get it wrong. And nobody was held accountable from it in terms of the government or the military for getting it wrong either. So, I mean, it's so incentivized not to root this out. And as long as people are making money from it within boxing, like, this is not where you look for ethical and moral integrity in society. Is like, oh, let's go to boxing to find it, because it's the ultimate. No,
the ultimate, not
it's the ultimate. Well, yeah, it's the ultimate black box, which is itself an extension of the ultimate example of the worst impulses of capitalism writ large is boxing.
Well, and I guess that's also one of the reasons why, like I said, I don't want to just bring down the conversation. We had a great fight last night and I don't want to dull it, but I do think that that's what you just said is one of the reasons why it's important to talk about it, because nobody else is gonna, that's the whole problem, is that nobody else is going to even address it at all. And if they do, it's going to be in passing and just kind of like, oh fuck, we got to talk about this again type of thing. And those conversations are difficult. I use the term cognitive dissonance quite frequently, because that's what these kind of conversations produce. They make you think in a way that's uncomfortable and you don't want to think about it, because they challenge your already well-balanced worldview. Or maybe it's not well-balanced, but regardless, that's one of the reasons why I like to at least just bring these things up, so that they're a little bit more out in the open and not quite as mysterious. But again, not to take over the excitement and the entertainment value of the fight last night, because it was incredible, and any of these associations have nothing to do with that.
Well, but I agree with you. MTK's relationship with Tyson Fury, I mean, people have died in Europe. It's documented of people getting murdered and that kind of thing. And
well, we have at least part of it on video. Somebody getting shot right. up in a hotel weigh-in with, you know, fucking Kalashnikovs, man. You know, pretty serious shit.
Well, no. And I mean, a lot of these places, like, you know, where is Triller getting their money from? Like, we don't really know. You know, like, like a lot of these areas of combat sports are such havens for people, as I say, that are just black boxes and nobody gives a shit.
Just, there's just massive money laundering operations. That's yeah. literally all it is.
Because again, there's no barrier to entry. There's no governance. There's no transparency. And I mean, as you mentioned with Don King earlier, and you can go back, I mean, Customato is the one who has integrity to stand up to the mob. Bullshit. He was with the mob. He just maintained the image of being against the mob when it was convenient. So you couldn't play ball.
You did all that shit to pay Patterson.
Yeah.
And yeah. Anybody that was a good contender, whether it be Zora Foley, Eddie Mach, and all of that, they were mobbed up. And that's why Patterson couldn't fight them. Tom yeah. McKinley, but instead. Yeah.
No, and I mean, even Ali with the Nation of Islam, they robbed him blind. You know, this great moral champion of character, whatever. He never stood up to them for a second. He said openly, look what they did to Malcolm X. They'll do it to me. And they robbed him blind. He retired with nothing. The only reason he had any money was signing that licensing deal. But he left boxing with nothing, with an organization that was bragging about meeting the Ku Klux Klan and aligning themselves with L. Ron Hubbard. And, you know, he was anti-civil rights all over the place, pro George Wallace, you know, like, so, you know, there's a lot of dark shit here with people that are very easy to exploit, that are bringing in huge amounts of money. Nobody knows where it goes. Why does a boxing manager deserve a third of these guys' income relative to like an agent? Like, I mean, I have a literary agent. They take 15%. That pisses me off. But a third of all my money, what would you make as an agent in baseball or other sports?
Carl King would take 50%.
Well, yeah, or make you sign a contract.
What did he ever do besides being Don King's kid?
Right.
Absolutely.
I remember Bernard Hopkins talking about Carl King a number of times. Yeah.
So I just mean, like, what is there exactly to prevent this kind of thing? And you know, it's
and what is anybody gonna do about it? I guess that's the prevailing question. What the fuck is anybody gonna do about it?
No,
the answer,
I mean,
for the most part, is nothing.
Nothing. Well, there's an issue. Like, it's funny. There was a great article in the Times the other day about Tony Soprano, and it was just saying that, like, the mob can't exist anymore because, well, where's the numbers racket with the mob? Well, it's called the lottery, and every state has it. Illegal gambling. What if you make it legal and just put it on a First Nations reserve? Well, how do you shake down and exploit people anymore? Or like lending operations, loan sharking. Well, there is no loan sharking anymore because you can just go get a payday loan. It does the exact same thing. So it's like all of this criminality that we were trying to root out has just become institutionalized. It's just completely standard.
It's been rebranded. It's just been rebranded.
Exactly. Oh, the worst thing about the communists is living under surveillance. Well, who's more surveilled than us in the US? So, I mean, it's, you know, boxing is this other world where we like to look in and go, oh my God, it's such criminality and nobody's there to stand up for it. But I don't know. It's just a more extreme version of what we already have in a lot of ways.
Well, like you worded it very well, that it was a lot of the aspects, the worst aspects of communism that have just been allowed I think you just said communism and that got in my brain. But yeah, the worst aspects of capitalism that have just been allowed to run amok. But
and just lastly on that, though, is it's always funny when I talk to people outside boxing, they go, what's great about boxing? It's so simple. It's just two guys in a ring beating each other. And it's like, well, yeah, but, you know, Floyd Mayweather made $200 million for playing tag. I mean, that's a lot of money you know, Mike Tyson coming out of jail for a rape conviction represented $1 billion stimulus to Las Vegas every time he would fight. That's how much for hotel rooms, all the ancillary stuff. Like, this is really big, really complicated, really meaningful, and it has no governance. It's like a Super Bowl every time you do it. And, you know, and yet it still has a reputation for just being like totally unimportant and trivial and meaningless in relation to capitalism. But to me, it was always like the most interesting byproduct of it.
Aris, are you off the bomb squad?
I don't think I was ever on the bomb squad, to be honest. I don't know if I even say that. I went into this fight feeling neither Fury nor Wilder, but nah, I'm just worn out, man. I'm sorry. I'm like, keep on going.
Oh, no. I didn't mean it like that. No, just, Bryn and I are over here just going off, but I know that you're feeling a little under the weather, but man, also beyond feeling under the weather, dude, I almost feel kind of worn out after the fight last night, because there were several times where I was like, all right, I'm watching, and there aren't a whole lot of fights that make you exclaim out loud. And I was like, oh shit, like five different times during the fight, you know?
I was already mentally exhausted after, and I looked, and I was like, it's only been seven rounds and all the shit that we went through in that first half. I was like, my God, man, what else is this going to bring? That was like 20 rounds worth of action, let alone 15. You know, that was wild. When you pack that much action into something, you get so invested into it. I'm not even going to lie. That would have been difficult for me to like keep my composure if I was ringside counting that. Like, that's one of those fights that are going to test you. You can't help it. Like, your emotions kind of take over at some point. You just kind of like, you know, like it was heavy. But that's what makes these things great. Like, some people mentioned, you know, that's as much as we hate things about boxing, there's so many different reasons. You can go on for days complaining about the sport and what goes on with it. But when something goes right, like last night, and that fight happens, that's what, you know, basically why everybody loves it and why you remember why you're a fan in the first place. Like, there's really nothing like it.
Well, you know, the rest of the card, we mentioned it on the preview, and it wound up being actually overall pretty entertaining card. You know, I got to give credit where it's due. It wasn't the greatest card on the face of the planet, but, you know, Adam Konaski, I think I would just kept calling him Kownacki on the preview, but you know, I gotta get in, you know, like when they do go, like lean real hard into the pronunciation, I gotta get on board.
Lennox.
Adam Kownacki. No, he looked awful, and I have no idea why, beyond the fact that he's white, they kept trying to push him as some sort of next anything. He's got good power and that's about it. Doesn't move his hand. Hellenius just absolutely handled him, had very few problems, and Konaski's eye looked like absolute shit. Frank Sanchez kind of snoozed most of the fight, his way over Efe Ajagba, and in the other heavyweight fight, Vladimir Tereshkin had absolutely no business being in there with Jared Big Baby Anderson, which I was like, right before that fight happened, I know I'm trying not to go too much on a tangent here, but Brian Kenny was absolutely fucking terrible on that broadcast. He sounded like he was coked out the entire time. Like, he just wouldn't shut the fuck up. And right before that fight, he starts going on and like basically going down a laundry list why this dude, Vladimir Tereshkin, shouldn't be in this fight. He hasn't fought in 2 years. He wasn't that good before he fought. He wasn't probably. And I'm thinking, well, then why would you put this as the opening fight on the card and then say that right before the fight happened? What are you doing? Do you want people to watch or do you not want them to watch? What the fuck are you doing, buddy? And you know, anyway, but whatever. The rest of the undercard was actually fairly interesting. J-Rock Williams wind up losing to Vladimir Hernandez, man. You know, that was a little bit of an upset with J-Rock on the comeback trail after being stopped. You know, Edgar Berlanga wound up getting hurt pretty bad against Marcelo Caceres. You know, there was quite a bit to go around. I mean, it was a pretty enjoyable undercard. Did Bryn, I forgot to ask you when you were talking about the theater earlier, did people seem pretty enthused by what they were seeing?
Definitely. I mean, it was totally pro Wilder crowd. So, as I say, I wasn't particularly cheering for either guy, but I mean, every time Fury would land something, I kind of involuntarily clap it, and I could feel, you know, fuck you. Like, just don't cheer on this guy. So it might have some bearing on the result. But no, it was a crowd. I mean, it was boxing nuts. They were all had their phones out following other things. So it was a good crowd. I mean, you always feel weird cheering at a screen instead of like the real deal, but it's fun. I mean, it's as close as you can get to kind of being there is, I think, going to a theater. So I do like the experience.
Yeah, it's not quite as fun. Aris and I both were sitting at home watching it. I wished I could have seen a fight like that around a bunch of people, but still a lot of fun. The card itself was pretty fun too.
Yeah, I mean, I would have preferred to watch it with my cats, But I mean, next best.
I would prefer to watch it with Mike Katz, personally.
he could definitely use some manscaping.
Yes. Oh, Jesus. Every product that they have.
So yeah, I hope they have something to clean his neck brace, that poor little fellow. New York people from the boxing scene are probably laughing their face off right now. Everybody else is like, what are they talking about? Oh man, the most Yoda looking human being on the face of the planet.
I wish there was video footage of his fight with Wally Matthews.
It was Ron Borges.
Ron Borges, yeah.
Yeah, he accused Ron Borges of being paid by Don King, and Ron Borges got all pissed off and they started clawing at each other at a press conference. Like, and they had to be pulled apart and shit. I mean, I wasn't there, I didn't see it, but I remember
Borges slapped him and Kat started poking him with his cane.
Yeah, he started trying to hit him with his cane. That's some epic shit, dude. That's how real boxing writers fight. They take their capes and canes and shit.
Or the other one from years ago where I read, I forgot the writer's name, but Teddy Atlas was at a press conference for a fight, might have been for something for Michael Moore, and he jumped off the stage and got into a fist fight with a writer who he didn't like, who I guess he used to had previous relationship with for boxing.
Oh, Teddy.
And got pulled away with a busted lip.
Dude, Teddy has gotten into like three fights and lost them all. He's gotten into like three different fights at like press conferences and has gotten tipped up every single time. Teddy, stop it. What are you doing? Yeah. Oh my goodness. Look, it was a lot of fun last night. Definitely one of the kinds of fights to add to the annals of heavyweight boxing history. No question. I appreciate you guys jumping on so quickly the following morning to do a real fun recap and getting back together again today. It's a lot of fun. Thank you guys.
Lots of fun.
It's a blast.
I want some manscaping merch.
Hell yeah, dude. We're gonna see what we can do about this manscaping business for manscaped business.
Well, I have two male cats also, so I think feline manscaping is definitely, dude, something that we need to look into.
No, I really do appreciate you guys. And everybody who actually sat through this entire episode, go watch the fight. I appreciate it, but go watch the fight again. You'll definitely get something out of it there. But if you wouldn't mind actually subscribing on YouTube, helpful. Subscribing on all of the podcast apps, also helpful when it comes to social media. Twitter, for instance, you can follow Bryn Jonathan Butler on Twitter at Brinicio, BRINICIO. Follow my buddy Aris Pina at Punch Zone Aris. Me, Patrick Connor, at Patrick M. Connor. If you're on Facebook and Instagram, you can go and find Knuckles and Gloves podcast on both of those platforms as well. And boys, a heavyweight adieu.
Blame Bobby. That's the one hashtag that was not mentioned in either of the hashtag Wilder Fury fights. Yeah. I know who was to blame for the fight. It was not Breland. It was that fucking Bobby Chez.
That's right.
Blame everything on Bobby Chez.
Yeah, you
see, we're getting Aris in on this. Hashtag blame Bobby.
Drunk, driving, maniac.
Easy. We love you, Bobby. We'll have you on the show soon.
Sure.
Yeah, we'll do a crossword so you can see, you know, flex those Mensa muscles for us, Bobby.
Perfect. All right, boys. Leave Bobby alone. I'll talk to you soon.
See you later, man.